Great to see everyone here tonight, and I'm very thankful to be here and to be your moderator as well. Judges has so far been a fascinating book. It's been good for me, I know, to get back into the Old Testament, remember some of these, I hate to use the word stories, but accounts of things that happened so long ago that we often talk about and reference perhaps in a sermon somewhere, in a topical lesson, but to study them out further and to glean the meaning is very beneficial, and I'm enjoying the study. Chapter 3 is the true beginning of the book of Judges, or of the time of the Judges. Chapters 1 and 2 give some backstory, and it ends there with Joshua dying, and the generation around Joshua dying as well. And then there arises a generation that does not remember the things that happened prior, that forgets the Lord, and Judges chapter 2 talk about the endless cycle that the time period of the Judges is surrounded with. Chapter 3, we see this happen twice in just the period of these verses here. And we see it happening with Othniel and Ehud and Shamgar, also in the time of Ehud. So Judges 3 has three judges in it, and that's a little unusual for any chapter, really, of the book. I think it's the chapter per capita of judges is highest in chapter 3, if you want to notice it that way. So we will begin tonight by looking at this first question here, and I believe Landon will have the first question. No, Levi will have the first question. Okay. Which is, who was taught to know war in Israel? Why are the nations left amongst the children of Israel? And what was the problem with marrying foreign wives?
I kind of ran around with this one a little bit. Got to the dirt a bit, but I was trying to figure out something that was a little bit more concrete. So who was taught to know war in Israel? To not really answer it, but just kind of say what the Bible says, because I kind of have a hard time answering this one. This was only so that the generations of the children of Israel might be taught to know war, at least those who had not formally known it. So there is a group of Israelites who had not formally known war that need to be taught it now. And I'm not sure what age group this is, or it's probably younger. Why are the nations left among the children of Israel? To judge them. For punishment. They've committed a lot of sin, so now it's time for the Lord. He's not protecting them from these people. These people are going to be thorns in their side. What was the problem with marrying foreign wives? Got a couple verses here. Deuteronomy 7, verses 2, verses 2 through 5, I guess. I think it's just the first two and verse 3. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them, nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their daughter for your son, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Lord will be aroused you and against you and destroy you suddenly. So they're a bad influence, and it's a general warning to stay away from them.
Very good. Other comments here on number one, war.
Who was taught to know war in Israel? Numbers 1, Numbers chapter 1, verse 3. If you're 20 years old and above, all are able to go to war in Israel. You and Aaron shall number them by their armies. So anybody over 20, except verses 47. But the Levites were not numbered among them by their father's tribe. For the Lord had spoken to Moses, saying, on the tribe of Levi you shall not number, nor take a census among them, the children of Israel. Skipping down to verse 53. But the Levites shall camp around the tabernacle of testimony, that there may be no wrath of the congregation of the children of Israel. And the Levites shall keep charge of the tabernacle of testimony. So everybody 20 and older was not.
Very good. Yeah, that's great information. And I think it explains kind of the transition period here, and why it's not that you know, they didn't know war at all, or no one knew war, but this generation, which would be those who were under the age of 20, the underage people, if you will, they didn't know war, and now they need to be taught war. Other comments? A couple things that I thought was rather interesting. Clark had a comment about why this generation needed to be taught war. And he says, had they been faithful to God, they would have no need of learning the art of war. But now arms become sort of a necessary substitute for that spiritual strength which had departed from them. And thus, God in his judgment leaves one iniquitous nation to harass and torment after another. We're all to turn to God. Men need learn war no more. And that reminded me of Isaiah chapter 2, verse 4, which says, a prophetic verse about the church, I believe. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people that shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. So them learning war was a consequence of the fact that they didn't obey God. Had they obeyed God, there would be no need for war. There would be no need for bloodshed, because they would have taken care of all of these different nations that the Lord intentionally left among them to test them, to see what they would do with them. Kaufman had a couple of reasons. He says, to prove them, that was a reason why they were left, to teach those ignorant of the art of war, and a third reason, of course, is that of punishing Israel for their disobedience. So a couple good things, I thought, said by these men. And I would also point out that, just as Levi pointed out in the verse that he read, they weren't supposed to take foreign wives because of their influence towards idolatry. Now, we know from the example of Rahab, of course, she was a Gentile. She was of the people, and yet she was brought in and made part of the Israelite nation, and in fact, part of the lineage of Jesus. Also, Ruth, in the same time period, in the time period of the Judges, a Moabitish woman, was brought in. So the danger was not necessarily just that they were foreign. And I think Lauren brought up this when we were studying Ezra, correct? Towards the end there. That perhaps, more specifically, it's those who are foreigners who are idolaters. More specifically, those who will not give up, those who do not want to be actually part of the children of Israel in the sense of following the God of the Israelites. They just want to marry them and follow their own gods. So a couple of things of interest there. And I would say Ruth and Rahab are the exceptions rather than the rule on that. Other comments? Yeah, Mark.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. And I think there's other exceptions too. And those would be all the Egyptians that left with the Israelites. Because there were Egyptians that went out with the Israelites when they left Egypt through the Red Sea. And those people were integrated into the nation of Israel, but they made a decision that I want to be part of the Hebrew nation, and so they were allowed.
Yeah, that's a good example too, because when you read the Torah, there are provisions made for those who are not your brethren, those who sojourn among you, and people such as that, to give them an opportunity to turn to the Lord and become a part of the nation, and how to treat them, even though they are not flesh and blood relative to the nation. So, yeah, I think that's really good. Other comments before we move on? Okay, question number two for Bill. Why might Othniel have been chosen by God as the first judge? And what was involved in taking on this position of judge? What authority did it have, and what prohibited others from taking on this role?
Well, I'd like to first start. You kind of mentioned this in the beginning, Austin, that the first two chapters are kind of a prelude, and where I was reading, these first six verses were kind of a conclusion to the preface, and now we're really getting. Now we're going to start marching through the judges. So, you know, this first question: why might Othniel have been chosen by God as the first judge? I was struggling, kind of like Levi was talking. I dug around a little bit, and it mentions Caleb. So I thought, well, okay, he came from good stock. He had good family. Caleb's younger brother, and this idea of a brother led into quite a few different questions in my mind when you start looking at when Caleb might have died and now how many years have it's the chronology doesn't seem to quite line up. So I was kind of wondering if this brother just meant he was part of that family. He might have been a second or even a third generation nephew or whatever it would be to be the next generation of Caleb. So definitely related to Caleb, his family tree. What was involved in taking on this position as judge? Well, several of them were called. They were called of God, Gideon, Jephthah, Samson. Others were lifted up. And I'm not really, you know, somehow the Lord made it possible for some of these men to be recognized as leaders. They were lifted up, and maybe they had it in there, and maybe they realized the Lord's impacting me and I need to do something. So I'm not real sure. Called and lifted up. That third question, what authority did it have, this position of a judge? Well, it was authority given by God. You read this different things, and I couldn't really see how the people recognize a judge on their, it's almost like the judge comes to the people and says, the Lord's, I've been moved, I've been lifted up, I've been called. So I don't really know how that's authority unless it's just authority given by God. I'd be interested in some other comments. That fourth question, what prohibited others from taking on this role? Well, again, I didn't really know. The Lord's in control. The Lord picked and chose who he wanted for different reasons. Think of Shamgar, just for different reasons, the Lord picked these guys. So that's about as good as I could come up with on these questions. Levi did a great job. I'll just say Cushan, the Cushan group. that phrase, I saw a couple of interesting explanations of that phrase. It might mean Ethiopian of double iniquity. I found that phrase, and I found another phrase that this Cushan means, Nubian of double-dyed wickedness. I thought, wow, Nubian of double-dyed wickedness. And it was thought that this was maybe, because this group can't be found, this Cushan group can't be found, so it was thought that this was maybe a negative nickname that Israel might have had for this group. I thought that was kind of interesting to learn about.
That is. That's extremely interesting. Really appreciate that answer. I think you and I are kind of on the same page on these questions here. Other comments? About Othniel. Mark?
Yeah, that was real good, I thought, for Bill. And what prohibited others from taking on this role? Well, as Bill pointed out, they weren't picked by God, but I thought about for 40 days, all the Israelites standing on the hills of Israel listening to Goliath. Come out and fight! And nobody does. Because why? They were afraid. Mm-hmm. And here comes little David, and David's not afraid. And so why didn't somebody else step up and take the authority? Because they were all scared. It's pretty simple. And God took the person that he chose and enabled them to be a hero.
Mm-hmm. I think that's Those two things, that of being chosen by the Lord and fear itself, are really good explanations, because I think we might look at this, and what I was kind of thinking about when writing out this question is, well, you know, surely there was some hotshot young gun in the group that, hey, I'll just be a vigilante and I'll just lead everything. If no one else is going to do it, then I'll do it. And maybe there were some of those, and they got killed off pretty quickly. But that's what makes the judges unique. And I think as far as what authority they had and what is wrapped up in this position of a judge is really wrapped up in what this phrase means. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel. So the questions that we have are answered, really, with that statement.
I thought I had something good here, but I guess I don't.
Here we go. This is Clark again. He says, by the Spirit of the Lord coming upon him, the Chaldee understands the spirit of prophecy. Others understand the spirit of fortitude and extraordinary courage as opposed to the spirit of fear or faintness of heart. But as Othniel was judge and had many offices to fulfill besides that of general, he had need of the Spirit of God in the proper sense of the word to enable him to guide and govern this most refractory and fickle people. And his receiving it for these purposes shows the political state of the Jews was still a theocracy. No man attempted to do anything in that state without immediate inspiration of God, with intention to which always justified by the event. And I thought that was a really good explanation as to what judges are all about. A judge is not a king. They don't operate as priests, but they do operate as sort of a governor or a ruler. That's some of the other definitions of what a judge is. And they, and within that is the concept, of course, of a deliverer. So a couple things to think about with that. All right, let's move on to question number three. Oh, Laura?
I think one interesting thing to see in this, besides what you ask, is it's Cushan Rithaim, king of Mesopotamia. This is different than the other ones in that Mesopotamia, I believe, would be like the Babylon area. This is outside of Canaan, I think, is where this king came from.
That sounds right. I didn't check on that specifically, but so yeah, that would make them unusual. Perhaps in Judges.
Yeah, Mark. Yeah, that's totally right. So the first opponent is from the north. The second opponent, the Moabites, is from the east. And the third opponent is from the west, I think, is the way it actually works out. The Philistines, the Shamgar fights, are along the Phoenicians. So north, east, west, so three different directions.
Correct. And then you've got, yeah, that's good. I'll stop there. Anything else? All right, question number three. This is for Hunter, if you like it. Who is Eglon, and how did he defeat Israel, and what's notable about him? Who did God raise up to be the next judge, and what was his primary physical feature?
All right. So I'm sure someone will be able to add some more depth to my answer here. Eglon was king of Moab. He defeated Israel. I mean, it was by God's providence. You know, it says God strengthened the hand of Eglon. But it seems that it was through his, I'm losing the term, there's a military term when you unite the different forces. But he united these, the people of Ammon and Amalek. So I guess coalition maybe. He had a coalition with all these people and was able to conquer them that way. Who did God raise up to be the next judge? That was Ehud. And his primary physical characteristic that we were told, oh, I guess I skipped to what is notable about Eglon, was very large, as we see in verse 17. He was a very fat man, which back then was the sign of opulence and wealth and power and things of that nature. He also, the city of Palms there, I believe, is Jericho in verse 13. So kind of took that one. So God raises up Ehud to be the deliverer, and his primary physical characteristic that we read about in he's left handed.
Yeah.
So I can't find the verse right
now. 15.
Oh, okay. Hey, there we go. Benjamite, Andy was a Benjamite, direct descendant from Benjamite. Which I guess maybe there was a lot of left handed Benjamites. I'm not sure about that. But I think the imagery here, and I heard Bart say before services as well, I guess in the original Hebrew, his hand was bandaged or had some sort of deformity, maybe. But the imagery is he did present himself as a warrior type. Like he had a very, had a more passive appearance, so that this assassination attempt that he undergoes was a lot more practical. And he wasn't the warrior type, per se.
Yeah. I think that's really, really good. All that. Other comments? Mark?
It's interesting that Moab, so Lot had two sons through his daughters. And the oldest was Moab, and the younger was Ammon. So the Moabites call on their brother. And Amalek, I had forgotten who Amalek was. Amalek was a grandson of Esau. So these people are all related, because Lot was in the family of Abraham. So they're cousins, and Moab calls upon Ammon and Amalek to help them against their hated relative. It's one way to look at it.
It's the worst family feud episode, perhaps, in the Bible. But I forgot about Amalek. But that makes more sense, because I feel like coalitions, like Hunter was talking about, wasn't very common back in that time period, or as common as obviously we have today with, you know, United Nations and things like that, where nations join with other nations quite frequently, and for better or worse. But in this instance, like you say, I like that point, drawing upon family ties to go against the black sheep of their family in their view. So, yeah, very good. Other comments?
Judges chapter 20 and verse 16, they're going, getting ready to go to war, a bunch of Benjamites, and there's 700 left-handed Benjamites. And I kind of, again, reading some of this, this idea that that these Benjamites were excellent fighters, and maybe the possibility, this whole deal with, you know, makes me wonder if he was faking it, you know, if he was really ambidextrous. I read that from some writers, thought that these Benjamites were super fighters. What that? I think it's in chapter 20, verse 16, that they could sling a stone and a hair's breadth. So they're both really good fighters. So I thought that was kind of interesting to learn about. And then this Ehud, the son of Gera, one of Benjamin's sons. And again, don't know if the chronology works right, how many generations it might have been.
Yeah. You know, another thing about that too, and I like the idea of him having some kind of malady, a deformity, or something like that. To me, that makes more sense that he would be able to sneak a dagger into a one-on-one conversation with a king, because that whole thing seems very odd.
Yeah, and this probably, I was thinking about this and trying to take this scenario through my mind with him going before the king, bringing this big procession of gifts and things. This likely was not the first time Ehud had come to the king of Moab delivering the tribute money, the food, grain, whatever. So this was probably a routine that he'd done a few times, had a little bit of confidence there.
Right. That makes sense too, because under Othniel's reign, or before that, they were under bondage for 8 years, or under oppression for 8 years. Under Eglon, they're under oppression for 18 years. So that is a significant portion of time, and it would make sense that there would be some kind of relationship that they had already established. This wasn't just the first time he shows up on his doorstep. Other comments? I was trying to think a little bit. Of course, if you're anything like me and have the humor of a 10-year-old child, you might, you know, chuckle a little bit. Well, he was a very fat man. Everybody loves that. But I was trying to think, you know, how fat was he actually? And I was trying to picture that today, me and Levi were. Because back then, of course, being fat, as Hunter mentioned, was a sign of power and influence and things of that nature. And with the obesity the way that it is today in America, was he just a regular American type of fat, or was he someone who needed a scooter going into Walmart type of fat? I couldn't quite picture it in my mind, but a cubit length dagger, that's about 18 inches or so, sinking all the way in. I'm kind of leaning towards the latter. I think he was in the unhealthy range of obesity type of fat in order for that to happen. But that's, again, besides the issue. Okay, let's move on. Dennis, if you'd like this next question. Why is this particular event of political assassination part of the biblical narrative? there meant to be a deeper spiritual meaning, or is it present purely to show the power of God's judgment and deliverance?
Well, I didn't go to the speculative response. I pretty much have what you guys just talked about. But to answer with the, kind of the note of information, that he was a Benjamite, and of course he mentioned as Judges 20:16, he was left-handed man. Bill mentioned using the sling in battle. However, also the being left-handed is perceived as being kind of a drawback in normal battle. And, so God used Ehud along with the perceived handicap, calling him to accomplish the purpose and maybe demonstrate that he can use, like Gideon, using people who don't necessarily fit the bill in our eyes. He also displayed courageous faith in doing what he did, along with killing 10,000 Moabites and freeing Israel from bondage. So I really don't know. Maybe other people have some more information on that part of it. The deeper spiritual meaning, one thing I came up with, is Ehud is called a deliverer. And in the broadest sense, all judges can be looked upon as foreshadowing the perfect deliverer, Jesus Christ, who delivers us from sin.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Other comments? Mark?
I agree with what Dennis says. One thing that I found interesting is, let's see, what verse is it there? You don't have the verses up. It's the verse that says, he turned back from the stone images that were at Gilgal. Is that 18 or 19?
19.
Okay, so they deliver the tribute. There's a bunch of people, as Bill said. They leave. They go back to Gilgal, which is 10 miles away. So this is Jericho, where the Moabites set up a camp. They deliver the tribute. He's already armed the first time he goes in. They leave. They go back to Gilgal. He sends everybody home. And then he alone turns back from the stone images. What are those stone images? What was set up at Gilgal? By Joshua and the people. And if you look back in Joshua 4, it says that stones were set up from the Jordan, 12 stones, and Joshua said, this is a sign among you, this is verse 6 of chapter 4, when your children ask in time to come, saying, what do these stones mean to you? You shall answer them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it crossed over the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan cut off. These stones shall be a memorial to the children of Israel. Gilgal has already been mentioned in the previous chapter. The Lord came from Gilgal. The angel of the Lord came from Gilgal. Ahab goes to Gilgal. And apparently the Moabites set up false images there. It says the stone images. And so they had desecrated the Lord's memorial. So Ahab sees this desecration. And he sends the people back, and he's like, I've got to do the mission that I decided I was going to do before. It's a suicide mission. I'm going to die, but I'm going to go in there, and I'm going to kill the king. So what's the significance? The significance is when the enemies of the Lord desecrate his memorial, then we don't stand for it. If the people of the Lord stand up for the traditions the Lord has given us. Those stones were there so the children would remember the Lord, not the children would remember Baal and Asherah, so that the children would remember the Lord. And so he goes back, and somehow he's able to get a private interview. And I think this has something to say about the perversion of Eglon. And I'm not going to go too deep into this because it's a little perverse, but I think when Ehud says, I have a secret message for you from God, you know, pagan religion was all about immorality. Mm-hmm. And I think that he's suggesting to Eglon immorality. And Eglon sends everybody out, and then that is when Ehud kills him. So I think this is giving us a picture of the perversity of Eglon and the strength and the honor and the nobility of Ehud to decide, I'm not going to stand for it. We're not going to have this desecration of the Lord's memorial. And if it costs me my life, I'm going to fight back. So that's what I see.
Yes. I really appreciate that, because I think you're right. I think there's something a little bit more perverse. Now that you're saying that, I can see it very, very vividly. And we can ask the question, why are these things in the scriptures? Why is this in the Bible? And I think it's for the purpose of, like you said, the people of God need to stand up for what is right, and they need to hold fast to the traditions. I love that call back to Gilgal. But also to show that when the Lord cast his judgment upon someone, the Lord humiliates his enemies in every possible way. This is humiliating. If you're Eglon, or if you're the king's servants, you don't want to tell the nation how Eglon died. No one wants to do that. This would be horrifying and embarrassing in every possible way. But that's what we see God doing over and over again. We're going to see it in chapter 4, that Sisera was delivered into the hand of Jael, the wife of Heber there, in a very emasculating position right there. So whenever the Lord brings about judgment, judgment comes in the most humiliating, embarrassing way possible. And I think that's something that we can draw from this. Now, there will be some people that, and I really like what's been said so far, because sometimes we get into a habit of our topical sermon, where we take an event like this and we try to attribute some Christian attribute to Ehud and to Eglon. Well, Eglon represents the devil and Ehud represents... And I think we need to be careful doing that, because what we've done here tonight is draw out the meaning. That's true exegesis. That's looking for the one meaning in here and finding patterns with the rest of Scripture. That's obviously very, very good things to do, instead of trying to read into what this passage is from our own perspective today as Christians. I think can be very dangerous. There are things to learn from this passage just by itself. We don't have to add something to that. Other comments? More.
I was mentioned that God had raised up Eglon back earlier in the chapter. And here, he raised up Eglon, that's in verse 12, and he raised up Ehud to deliver. So perhaps one of the deeper spiritual meanings is to show how God works in the kingdom of men to bring about his will. Mm-hmm. We think about Daniel 2:21. He changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the understanding.
Yes, absolutely. Go ahead.
Try to be quick. Let's see. I like the idea that we didn't mess with the tail end of verse 22, which was kind of interesting to me. If you read what the King James Version says about it, and think about this, what Ehud was able to do, and then escape. Think about the impact he had when he came back to Israel. It kind of spilled into the first part of question number 5, but I kind of wondered that, you know, for he to be able to accomplish this in the king's chamber and be able to walk out and get home and get out safely, you got to think that the people, Israel, knew that the Lord was with Ehud, mm-hmm. and would have maybe helped to bring about this rallying call. And then the two-edged sword. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 12. Ehud made himself a two-edged sword. And I'm not sure if your picture of Ehud in there with the hilt, if he took it in past the hilt to where, you know, there must not have been much of a hilt there for it to get in.
Maybe not. Only imagination can tell us.
Right.
Okay, question number 5 for Grant, if you'd like it, is why did the children of Israel listen to Ehud and come down from the mountains to fight? And what could be the reason that there was rest for 80 years instead of the usual 40 years of rest recorded in kind of the rest of the book?
Right. The first question there, why did the children of Israel listen to Ehud and come down from the mountains to fight? When Ehud came back, he went up to the mountains of Ephraim and blew the trumpet. So it really got the attention of all that was there.
we kind of see a reference back to essentially when they first went into the promised land and took over Jericho and blowing in the trumpets. Something that was probably well ingrained in their culture, that this is a calling sign from God to rally the people. And so you have left that blows the trumpet, and all people kind of come to battle and say, okay, we're ready to go. Mm-hmm. So rally the people with the trumpet. And then why could this be the what could be the reason that there was rest for 80 years instead of 40? We see verse 29 how not a man escaped. So of the 10,000 there that they had killed, it pretty much covered an entire generation of the Moabites. And governed essentially them being able to have children pretty easily for the next generation of that. So it's either it completely covered a generation and just set them back that much of that much time. That plus maybe perhaps it just instilled so much fear into the people around that they saw just the complete destruction of the Moabites. And like, okay, something's going on here. We're not going to go in there just yet. It takes 80 years from
Yeah, I really like that point about total destruction. Living, I guess, in a nation of 300 or more million people, we forget how big some of these nations actually were. And 10,000 strong was a formidable army. It still is today, but back then it was particularly formidable. And like you say, that cuts out a whole generation of people. It really sets them back. And yeah, I like that point. Other points?
Right. Real quick, yeah. Verse 1 of the next chapter tells us that when Ehud died, they did evil again. So I think Ehud lived the entire... So let's say he was 20 when he did this. Mm-hmm. He lived to be 100 years old, and he judged the nation, and he was a guy that didn't allow images. Right? We learned that he didn't appreciate the images that were at Gilgal. So Ehud's an amazing dude, and he doesn't allow the people to have any images. And we're just not told any of the specifics, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's kind of a shame that we, that really until this study, we don't view Ehud as highly, perhaps, as we need to. Like you say, generously, let's say he's 20 years old and lives to be 100. Maybe he's older than that and lives just by the strength of the Lord alone to the age of Joshua or Moses or someone like that. He's older when these events happen. And he gets overshadowed because Eglon is a very fat man. And that's not fair. It's not fair to Ehud because I think as we've noticed tonight, he is truly a good character of the Bible. He's a powerful, strong character. And there's a lot to be said with that. Let's conclude, Trace, with question number 6. Oh, I didn't copy and paste my verse. Oh, that's disappointing. And now I've completely marked it out. But the question is, who was Shamgar? Why do we know so little about him? And what does his singular recorded exploit say about him as a person? Verse 31.
So we do know very little about him. We know that he is the son of Anath here in verse 31 and later chapter 5. Says that he's the son of Anna in verse 6. And, you know, it's kind of like other individuals that are mentioned throughout the Bible. It's God's will. To me it kind of makes it, you can speculate a lot about this obviously, but to me it makes it kind of more powerful because he's just a random farmer and he gets his ox goad and takes out 600 I don't know if he survived, but he's named as deliverer of Israel. Mm-hmm. I have a good verse over here in 1 Samuel 17, verse 47. Now, this is the context of David and Goliath, but it says, "Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." And he's talking to about David and Goliath. And I think that's really powerful, and I think that Shamgar was the person at the time that God saw fit to use for his will. And he carried out his mission.
Excellent. Other comments here on question number 6? On Shamgar, the one verse judge. Well, I like that theory, Trace, and obviously we don't know for sure, but perhaps so little is written about him because, yes, he is a deliverer and he took out 600 men with an ox goad, but perhaps he died in battle. So he didn't get to live and have kind of the exploits and longevity of Ehud. That would make sense that there is a little written about him. But again, think of the magnitude that with an ox goad, which is a weapon, but not the cutting edge technology of the day, and he takes out 600 men with a single ox goad. That is incredible. And again, what we were talking about as far as what makes a judge, and the verse that Trace pointed out, the Spirit of the Lord had to have been with him in order for this to have been accomplished. Yeah, Trace, follow.
And I forgot to mention, these aren't just men, these are soldiers. These are Philistine soldiers.
Yes.
They are fully capable soldiers. And mm-hmm. It's
right. Right.
So that's impressive.
It's very, very impressive. Warren?
Your opening slide had a picture of Shamgar. So that the ox goad, I don't think anybody described it. What it looked like, what I saw was it was kind of like a pry bar with a scraper on one end and a point on another. So that was his weapon.
That's one of the, I didn't really know or not. I should have looked that up, I suppose. But there you have it, Bill.
Now, a little more detail. 8 feet long, 6 inches in circumference, which would be about 2 inches in diameter. Think the Kung Fu guy.
Okay. And again, 8 feet long, you know, that some might think that would be cumbersome. I would assume it would be a wooden handle, right? So, again, not your typical fighting weapon, obviously, but didn't matter. Trace?
Sorry, I had to put this in there too. The Philistines, they had sword, but they also had spears also. So mm-hmm. It's not like he was outranging anybody with his weapon.
Exactly.
So yeah. It was amazing.
Yeah. There's a lot to like about Shamgar. Let's close there. I appreciate everyone's study and attention on this particular chapter in Judges. I think we've uncovered some really good truths here tonight.